The Dark Web Files. Exposing the internet's hidden underbelly.
Imagine this for a second. You're in your self-driving car, gliding down the highway. You're reading, maybe catching up on emails. You trust the machine completely. But what if, miles away, someone in a dark room is bidding on the code that could take control of your car? What if your safety is for sale on the dark web?
That's a terrifying thought. And for me, that's what makes this topic so, so personal. I've always been fascinated by the promise of autonomous vehicles. I mean, the potential to eliminate human error, to make our roads safer, it's a future I've been genuinely excited about.
Right. It's the utopian vision.
Exactly. But the idea that there's this parallel world, this criminal economy actively working to undermine that vision, to turn that safety into a vulnerability, that's what I can't shake. It changes the entire equation for me.
And for me, it's the evolution of the threat. I've spent years tracking how darknet markets operate, how they trade in stolen data, drugs, weapons. It was always, you know, virtual or contained. But now that same model is being applied to things that move in the real world, things that carry people.
It's the jump from digital crime to physical threat.
Precisely. The stakes are just immeasurably higher. And that's what we're going to be exploring today. We're peeling back the layers of this multi-trillion dollar industry to look at the part nobody wants to talk about. We'll be talking to cybersecurity experts, we'll hear from people who have been on the inside, and we're going to venture into those shadowy corners to understand the very real risks.
So, join us as we investigate the invisible chauffeur and ask a question that might just keep you up at night. In the race to a driverless future, who is really in control?
So, to really understand how we got to a place where someone could even think about selling the code to a car, you have to look at the blueprint, the original proof of concept for this entire criminal economy.
You're talking about Silk Road.
The one and only. It's almost mythical now. But what it did was revolutionary. It wasn't just a marketplace. It was an entire ecosystem built on a single radical idea, creating trust between criminals who would never meet.
Which sounds like a paradox. How do you do that?
You mimic the legitimate world. They had vendor profiles, user reviews, star ratings, even an escrow system. The site would hold your Bitcoin until you confirmed you'd received your product.
So you could leave a one-star review for your heroin dealer if the shipment was late. That's an incredible thought.
It is. It worked for a while. But when law enforcement finally took it down, everyone thought, okay, experiment over. But they were wrong. All they'd done was prove the model worked.
Right. You cut off the head of the Hydra, and suddenly, two more grow back.
Exactly. Silk Road 2.0 popped up, run by the old admins. Then came others, like Agora, which eventually grew even bigger than the original. Each one learned from the last one's mistakes. It was forced, rapid evolution.
But that's just the external threat, right? The cops and the feds. What you're describing sounds like it has a fatal flaw baked right into its DNA.
Oh, it does. And it's arguably a much bigger threat to the people inside the system. It's called the exit scam.
An exit scam. So, the people running the show just run?
They run. Think about it. That escrow system, the one designed to build trust. It means the marketplace is holding millions of dollars in cryptocurrency at any given moment. What's to stop the anonymous administrators from just switching off the server and walking away with all of it?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Has that actually happened?
Spectacularly. There was a market called Evolution. In 2015, it was one of the biggest. Then one day, it just went offline. The admins vanished with $12 million worth of their users' Bitcoin.
$12 million? Wow. So the very mechanism that makes the market possible is also its greatest vulnerability. It's a ticking time bomb.
It creates this incredible paranoia. The users, both buyers and sellers, are caught in this constant dilemma. Who's the bigger threat? The FBI agent posing as a customer, or the anonymous admin who holds the keys to your entire wallet?
You can't trust the system, and you can't trust the people outside the system. It's a perfect trap. And that kind of desperation, that instability, that must be the environment where even more extreme ideas start to feel plausible.
Plausible is the word, because in that environment, risk is already the baseline. So your calculations change. Selling a kilo of cocaine carries a certain sentence. But what's the precedent for selling a vulnerability that could, theoretically, stop 100,000 cars on a freeway? It's a new frontier of crime.
So the paranoia we were talking about, the threat of the exit scam, it actually becomes an engine for diversification. You can't just rely on the old model.
It forces their hand. The smartest, or maybe just the most ambitious, operators start to see the limitations. They're middlemen in a volatile market. The real power, the real money, isn't just in facilitating the sale of, you know, a physical product. It's in selling something less tangible, but infinitely more powerful.
Access.
Access. Control. A zero-day exploit for a popular operating system. A backdoor into a corporate network. These aren't things you can just put up on a public listing next to counterfeit watches. The clientele is different. The stakes are astronomical.
So how does that transaction even happen? It feels like a completely different world from the Silk Road model of mailing a package and leaving a star rating.
Because it is. You see, the emergence of these, well, they're less like open-air bazaars and more like private auction houses. Invitation only. You have to be vouched for. The sellers aren't just some random vendor. They're hacking collectives, maybe even state-sponsored groups looking to monetize a tool they developed for espionage.
State-sponsored groups? Wait a minute. So you're saying a government might develop a cyber weapon and then sell it on the side to the highest bidder?
Or former intelligence operatives who take their skills and maybe some of their tools with them to the private sector. The lines get incredibly blurry. Think about it. Who has the resources to find a fundamental flaw in the control system of a major automotive brand? It's not your typical lone wolf in a hoodie. It takes a team, it takes time, and serious funding.
So the very nature of the product filters the participants. You can't just show up with a handful of Bitcoin and buy the keys to a city's infrastructure.
No, and the sellers are just as paranoid about their buyers as the buyers are about them. They need to know you're not law enforcement. They need to know you actually have the funds. So they develop these intricate vetting processes, multi-stage proofs. It's a world of digital handshakes in secret rooms.
And the item for sale, the exploit for a self-driving car. What does that actually look like? Is it just a string of code they email you?
It can be, but often it's more than that. It's a proof of concept video. It's ongoing support. Sometimes it's even sold as a subscription, a vulnerability as a service model, if you can believe that. They guarantee it'll work for a certain period, and if the manufacturer patches it, they'll work to find a new way in.
That's a business model. A terrifying but coherent business model. It takes this abstract threat and turns it into a reliable, marketable product. And that, I think, is the part that's truly chilling. It's not just chaos. It's organized, professionalized chaos being sold to the highest bidder.
And that's the paradigm shift, isn't it? It's moved from a crime of opportunity to a structured, corporate-style enterprise. They have product development, customer support, service-led agreements. It's just that their product is a potential catastrophe.
It completely reframes the problem. We think about car safety in terms of crash tests and seatbelts. The manufacturers are thinking about it in terms of firewalls and encryption keys. But they're in a defensive posture. They're patching holes. These groups, they're on the offensive, always looking for the next hole.
It becomes a perpetual arms race. And the scary part is, the car manufacturer has to win every single time. The attacker only has to win once.
And what does that do to us? To the person who's supposed to sit in that car and read a book? The entire promise of this technology is built on a foundation of absolute trust. But everything we've talked about today, it feels like it's systematically dismantling that trust before it's even been fully built.
I think, for me, the biggest takeaway is how this criminal ecosystem mirrors our own legitimate one. It evolves. It innovates. It responds to market forces. It's a dark reflection. And it proves that any new technology, no matter how utopian its promise, will inevitably be shadowed by a marketplace designed to exploit it.
That's a heavy thought. I keep coming back to something different, though. to the human element. For all the talk of code and networks and Bitcoin, this ultimately comes down to a person's safety being turned into a line item on a balance sheet.
Yeah, that's true.
And I'm left wondering, can we ever truly secure something this complex? Or is this just the permanent price of progress? A level of invisible risk we just have to accept if we want to move forward.
I don't think we have the answer to that yet, but it's the question we all need to be asking.
Well, that is all the time we have for today. Thank you for joining us on this journey into the shadows.
We hope it's given you a new lens through which to see the road ahead. I'm Mark.
And I'm Rachel. This has been The Invisible Chauffeur.